Welcome. This is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. It is the 11th of October 2011 here in Japan, and today I'm joined on the line by Bill Conroy, an investigative journalist whose work has been featured at narconews.com and who has been covering a great many number of cases that are not being reported on by the mainstream media or are only now being reported on by the mainstream media, even though he's been working diligently on these cases for a number of years. So, Bill Conroy, it's an honor to have you on the program today. Thanks for taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, it's good to be here.
All right, well, let's start. Obviously, this is your first time on the program, and so for people who aren't familiar with your work, perhaps you can just introduce yourself and the type of reporting that you've been doing over the years.
Yeah, well, for about, I'd say, 10, 12 years, late 90s, I started doing investigative reporting on the drug war, and specifically from the perspective of law enforcement corruption. And so essentially, my stories have all kind of followed that track up and down the Mexican border, and further west and east, because I've gotten out to the Miami and the and some of this stuff spreads into the Caribbean, and some of it spreads, you know, all the way out to the California coast. So, you know, I work a mainstream media job, and I Narco News is a nonprofit. We don't accept any commercial advertising, so this is my pro bono work, if you will. It's what I do. Because I'm unrestricted in terms of the investigative journalism I can do, and I don't get paid for it, but on the other hand, I don't have anyone telling me that I can't cover this or that, or I got to cover it a certain way. So it gives me the freedom to kind of pursue the story to where it's headed without an agenda.
And I think that definitely shows in the reporting that you do for Narco News. You certainly do a very thorough job, and it seems that you tend to put out stories as they're developing and when you get the information. So it truly is a great resource, and I do suggest people go there if they haven't already. But let's start talking about one of the cases you're working on at the moment regarding an accused Mexican drug trafficker, Jesus Vicente Zambada Niebla, part of the Sinaloa drug cartel. Perhaps you can, instead of focusing on the recent developments, perhaps we can step back for a moment and just sort of develop the larger story of what's happening here in the context of the latest developments.
Well, Zambada is the son of one of the top leaders of the Sinaloa cartel, which arguably is probably right now the most powerful drug trafficking organization in Mexico. And, you know, he was indicted back in by the United States for cocaine trafficking on a couple different charges, but this particular one was in Chicago for cocaine trafficking, and also they threw in some arms trafficking charges against him. And he was arrested in Mexico City back in 2009, extradited in February 2010. He's been sitting in a Chicago jail, downtown Chicago, since then, you know, in the process of putting his trial together. Now, the reason he's important is he himself is considered one of the top, part of the leadership of the Sinaloa cartel. And the top guy is someone named Chapo Guzman, who is quite infamous or famous, depending on how you want to use that term, in Mexico and in the drug war in general. He was escaped from jail in the early 90s and kind of rose from nowhere to become the head of this hugely powerful drug organization. And over the years, it's just grown, and it's kind of been accused of. And the problem with the drug war is, in Mexico in general, it's kind of a magic land in the sense that there's a lot of mirages, and you can't really tell what is real and what's not. And just when you think you have it figured out, it kind of, like, you know, you can grab onto it, and it vaporizes right in your hands. But in terms of the dynamics, it's pretty clear that there's been a struggle for marketplaces or plazas, as they call them, in the transportation routes for drugs into the United States, the U.S. being a huge market, the major world market, not the only, Europe's big too, but the biggest world market for drug consumption, illegal drug consumption, which drives all this. And the plazas are the major market entry points into the United States on the Texas side, Juarez, Nuevo Laredo, and a few smaller ones in between. And then you have Tijuana in California. And then the Miami connection is more of a Caribbean route. And where the Sinaloa cartels, you know, it was very much on the western coast of Mexico, but it's kind of spread its reach. And something called the Juarez cartel or the Vicente, they all have their own capos that they had at different times. But anyway, the Juarez cartel and controlled, as you would guess, the Juarez marketplace, the Juarez El Paso crossing. And that's an area I've kind of spent a lot of time on because it's in Texas. I've been up there. That and Nuevo Laredo were two flashpoints in the drug war. The early part of all the murders started in Nuevo. We first saw it in Nuevo Laredo. It spread to Tijuana, and then it came to Juarez. And Juarez is the murder city of the world right now. And the common denominator is Felipe Calderon, who's the president of Mexico, decided to, you know, put the military into action against what he said were these criminal drug organizations. And wherever the military went, ironically, and we traced this over the years, the violence would escalate. It wouldn't actually get better. It would get worse, leading many to believe the military was part of the equation in terms of the drug trade. And that's always been the amount of corruption between the state, local, and federal cops in Mexico and the military is well documented before me. So it's not a leap to see that. But Calderon kind of just turned up, you know, the thermometer on that. And so in all this, the Sinaloa cartel has seemingly benefited. They've seemed to be the one cartel that has grown in power, while these other ones, the Tijuana cartel, which is Arellano Felix brothers, pretty much wiped out. I mean, in Juarez cartel, which was Vicente Fuel Fuentes, excuse me, his organization was very powerful under Fox, and it's pretty much right now, depending who you talk to, it's pretty much, you know, petering out in Juarez. I mean, there's a tipping point there possibly. And across all of this, you have these paramilitary organizations springing up in Mexico. And you've always had those, the Zapatistas down the south. The state actually started these paramilitary organizations, or at least funded them, gave them arms to help take out the Zapatista rebels, which kind of were a self-determination movement that said, you know, the Mexican state's so corrupt, we're going to take back our land, an indigenous social movement. But the long and short of it is, one of these groups, called the Zetas, sprung up as a result of training we originally gave to the Guatemalan special forces, who then in turn trained the Zetas, which were defectors. The Guatemalan special forces that were trained by us, as well as some Mexican special forces that we trained as well, defected to the Gulf Cartel, which was another cartel that has since, you know, gone under since Calderon has come into office. It was the Sinaloa cartel battled it. Well, the Zetas were the part of them, and were the enforcement arm for the Gulf cartel. That's how they got their start. They were a paramilitary group, and this was the beginning of this paramilitarization of the drug war that we've seen over the last 5 years. Well, when the Gulf cartel fell, essentially it's there in pieces still, but when it lost its dominance, its monopoly, the Zetas also kind of fragmented, and they have now are another major force in the drug war, in that they have been on different sides at different times. It's not clear exactly who they are, but I mean, they are definitely part military. So I don't pretend to know how all these sides line up, okay? I mean, these are kind of the dynamics that are floating around out there. And my guess, just knowing how the drug war works and having covered a case pretty in-depth for years, the House of Death, which involved a U.S. informant being put in, who was a Juarez cartel member, being recruited as an informant for us and allowed to continue murdering people while he was an informant for us. It covered that for years, and the way got pretty far inside that to see that it's a very cellular structure, and the people don't necessarily know who they're working for at times, and it's strung together with a lot of, it's like Wall Street, it's fear and greed that keeps it together. Sorry for the analogy, but there's some truth there. And so it's very difficult, and alliances are constantly shifting. So it's very difficult to just, in the mainstream media really does a disservice when they say this whole drug war is just, you know, different drug organizations fighting over turf. It's simply not the case. It's far more complicated than that. And it's degenerated because of the way the military has been used in Mexico, to the point where, you know, you have common thugs shooting each other, and then you have another layer of you know, criminals that are a little more organized, and then you have you know, the bigger cap was on top of that that can use state force and state power to kind of get their way. And on top of that, you've got literally the economy of Mexico propped up by these billions and billions of dollars in the banks that, that make all this work. So to try to turn it into simple sides of one side against the other, this is, it's very difficult. It's really more of a culture that emerges. It's all immersed and very corrupt and dirty and hard to figure out. But within this, there are clearly groups that have a track record, or, you know, just like during Prohibition here, you had, you know, Chicago. Capone didn't run Chicago. His organization had its fingers in a lot of different things, but Capone was obviously somebody everybody knew. And it's the same with the drug organizations. Chapo Guzman is known. How much control he really has versus how much he's in league with other people that, you know, really have the control, and he's kind of the front man, the easy man to put out there. You know, that's all debatable. So we go back to Zambada, and Zambada is part of this group, the Sinaloa cartel, which has been around forever. They started out growing marijuana, and they branched into everything now. But their leadership, his dad is Ismael Zambada, and, you know, for some reason, nobody can catch these guys. they're not catchable, despite the fact that we've taken out most all these other leaders in the drug war down there. These guys seem to be, untouchable, basically. And that's another reason that feeds this whole thinking that what is going on with the drug war, and what is going on with our country and our, which brings us to the topic of this, our presence in another country when it comes to these things, when we want to, covertly influence foreign policy to the benefit of our U.S. national interests, which typically, are larger business and political interests. This goes back to who would we be favoring? What would our strategy be? And what would we do to affect that strategy? I mean, clearly we don't want a left-wing president in Mexico. That wouldn't work, and it came darn close in the last election. Calderon, some would argue, stole the last election. And there were plenty of U.S. people involved in helping him win that election, no doubt about it. And he fits more the profile, the type of leader that Washington would want in Mexico. A very conservative business type. He's going to take care of the business interests. He's not going to nationalize the banks. He's not going to, mess up trade deals. He's going to be very open to U.S. exploitation of Mexican assets, and so on and so forth. That's the kind of person typically we've put in power or supported in power in Mexico. So that's kind of the context of what is happening. We have this huge drug war going on. All of a sudden, this top guy with the Sinaloa cartel is picked up in Mexico City after he claims he's picked up right after meeting with DEA agents in a hotel in Mexico City. And the government agrees he did meet with DEA agents. Their stories kind of diverge from there. Zambada claims that he had been cooperating with the U.S. government for years, going back to, I think, 2004. And through an intermediary, another Sinaloa cartel leadership figure, a lawyer for them, whose job it was to basically get these guys out of jail and do deals for them, who is a cooperating source or an informant for the U.S. government. The U.S. government admits that, and he's been so for about 10 years. But they claim that there was no offer of any deals to any of these people. They were just helping this particular lawyer, and he was just helping the government out, with the hope that, they would leave him alone, because he had been indicted in California, but, he was in Mexico, and they claimed that they couldn't get him. Well, we know that isn't true, because they've extradited all these people up here. So whatever the case, they had a deep mole informant inside the Sinaloa cartel that the U.S. government admits, and Zambada said he was on that bandwagon, as was all the leadership of the Sinaloa cartel, that, in fact, they were all cooperating with the U.S. government in exchange for a quid pro quo, which says, leave us alone, tip us off if the Mexican government is on to us so we can hide, essentially don't prosecute us for our crimes. That's what they claim. The government, the U.S. government now in Chicago, the federal prosecutor handling it, says, well, that's not true at all. We never promised any blanket immunity. Zambada was never authorized to import tons of cocaine into the United States, and et cetera. And that's what's at issue in this trial, as is who's telling the truth about this. But what's already been conceded, and you know, and we've reported on it, is already mind-boggling, in the sense that we have the admission from the U.S. government that they had a high-level informant inside the Sinaloa cartel, who, by anyone's description on both sides, was a confidant of the top guy, Chapo Guzman, and Ismael has actually met with lawyers for and with these people, has been in meetings with them, has also been in meetings allegedly with with DEA and U.S. law enforcement. Of course, they don't talk about intelligence agencies in these briefings and these legal pleadings, because that's classified. But the point is, law enforcement's admitted at least 20 people met with Zambada in the court pleadings. We can choose to believe who we want here, but it's pretty clear the U.S. had its fingers pretty deep inside the Sinaloa cartel. Why they didn't scoop up Chapo Guzman or the leadership, or why they didn't take the cartel down, who knows? According to Zambada, the reason was they were feeding them information on rival drug cartels that was useful in attacking and taking down those rivals, such as the Juarez cartel, such as the Gulf cartel, such as the AFO and the Tijuana cartel. And if you look at the track record, all those drug organizations, those mafia organizations, are severely weakened since this Calderon's drug war has started, and the Sinaloa cartel is really emerging as the victor, with the Zetas being kind of the wild card. And we don't know really, I don't know where the Zetas line up. It's hard to tell. I've gotten reports that they actually work hand in hand with the military, and that the military is really the folks in control, and the Sinaloa cartel really doesn't have the enforcement arm for the Sinaloa cartel is imaginary, in the sense that it's the Calderon administration doing all this and the military doing all this. And these guys are business guys that know how to move drugs and make connections, but they're not, we don't know how it all fits together. I don't know yet, but that's kind of where this trial is at. Now, the problem is, as soon as these allegations come out from Zambada, the government pulls a card out of its hat, and it's called the Classified Information Procedures Act, CIPA. And it's a 30-year-old law, and it essentially is invoked when there are national security interests at stake that they don't want to leak out in a trial. And it sets it up so that anything that either the defense, the BATA, or the prosecution has that might be deemed classified has to first go to the judge. The judge has to look at it and say, yeah, it's relevant or it's not. No one else sees it if it's not. If it is relevant, can you word it differently or offer a substitution so we don't have to put the actual classified material in? And then he might make a suggestion. If the prosecution doesn't like it, then, that evidence doesn't get introduced under the form the judge suggests. And that could result ultimately in a mistrial or a yanking of the indictment for Zambada, which is why they're playing this game, because it's kind of a form of gray mail. On the other hand, what it's also conceding on the part of the government is there's some pretty dark secrets involved here. There's some things that they're not going to tell us that they say implicate national security. And I'll give you an example of where this has come up before so you can kind of visualize what it would be, because it's in the abstract, it's hard to understand. This came up in the case that Gary Webb covered of the CIA Contra cocaine connection. In one of the cases he filed, although Menendez was never brought to trial, there was a case around him called the Frogman case, where a bunch of frogmen, scuba divers, bought tons of cocaine into the coast of California, got caught and arrested, and then they started tracking this, where this cocaine came from. And one of the arrests they made, one of the leaders of this drug ring was a guy named Zabala, who was on trial. And during the course of the trial, among the things they seized from him to put him on trial were guns, cocaine, and cash. I think $32,000 in cash. And some of this stuff almost is humorous to me, because when you think about it, in the scheme of everything, $33,000 in cash isn't a lot of money, even back in the 80s, right? I mean, it's enough money, but it's not the kind of money you think a government would have a big, dirty national secret over. But it turns out in this case, the defendant, Zabala, says, well, that's not drug money. That was money given to me by the Contra leaders to buy them supplies to help them win their war down there. And of course, the prosecution says, well, that's just hearsay, blah, blah. And the guy goes, well, no, I can prove this. And he had two of the Contra leaders write letters to the court vouching for the fact that this was money they gave to this drug dealer to help them buy, you know, arms. Now, where did the money come from? Well, that's what Gary Webb was tracking. The money came from sales of cocaine on the street, basically. That would have been the next step. But what the government did, they didn't even want these letters introduced into trial, so they immediately invoked SIPA, and it was sealed. So we never got. Now, Gary's a good investigative reporter, so that's why we know this. But other than that, we wouldn't. But those letters were sealed. They were not to be no one was to know about this. And ultimately, the government took the money back. Usually they gave the money back because usually they keep the money, but apparently they must have wanted even that $32,000 at the time to get to the Contras, so they released the money. But this is the kind of thing that SIPA is used for, or can be used for, to kind of hide what they might call national security interests. So it could be some letter or some evidence that Zambada has or they think he might have that could show up in the court to prove or at least go a long ways toward, you know, showing some kind of nefarious relationship between the Sinaloa cartel and the U.S. government, which gets us to Fast and Furious. Zambada brings Fast and Furious up in his court pleadings, claiming that was part of what the government, the U.S. government was doing, was shipping arms to the Sinaloa cartel to help it defeat the other cartels. And the government comes back at him and says, well, you were in jail in 09, you know, March of 09, before Fast and Furious even started. How could you know it? Fast and Furious supposedly started like October of 09 and ran through the end of last year when a Border Patrol agent was killed and they found two of the weapons at the site, the Fast and Furious weapons at the site. And Fast and Furious was an operation where ATF, U.S. Law Enforcement Agency, ATF, is essentially allowing guns purchased by known cartel operatives to be smuggled across in the U.S. at gun stores, to be smuggled across the U.S.-Mexican border into Mexico, at which point they claim they were going to, gather intelligence to figure out who got them. Well, once they get into Mexico, it's a no-brainer. They disappear. So it made no sense as a law enforcement absolutely no sense as a law enforcement operation. And we find out recently that under the Bush administration, a similar operation was run out of Tucson in 2006, 2007. Now, whether there's more than this, I suspect there's probably a few more of these. There's one out of Columbus that looks suspicious, where at least 150 guns walked. The point being, this appears to be a practice that has been going on for a number of years, coinciding so far, we know, with the election of Felipe Calderon, who came to power in late 2006 in Mexico, the rise of the PAN party and during his election, of course, to 2006. We also find out that, so these are timeline things. And my reporting, I'm very careful not to draw connections that aren't there till I have evidence that they're really connected. But timelines are very important. And from the timelines, you can advance the reporting. So we have a timeline here of a corrupt ATF operation that was feeding guns into Mexico. And in the court pleadings for Fast, or in the letters leaking out of Congress and out of the Department of Justice for Fast and Furious, a good share of these guns were going to the Sinaloa cartel. That's proven. We have these guns going to the Sinaloa cartel. We have this allegation of a deal being cut between DEA, FBI, and ICE is what Zambada says. The leadership of the Sinaloa cartel is what he claims, a quid pro quo deal for, leave us alone, give us immunity in exchange for us ratting out our competitors so you can take them out. And the government denying all this, of course, but admitting, yeah, we have informants inside the Sinaloa cartel, admitting that, yeah, we did run Operation Fast and Furious. Yeah, it was a stupid operation, and as soon as we found out about it, whatever. Yeah, well, the things that are conceded already line up, and then we have the fact of a case that goes way back to 2007. And the nice thing, as I jump around here, because this is how it really happens, is things that connect in this world in this covert world don't connect immediately. It may take years for them to line up. And you know, the only way you're going to do it is keeping all the pieces. It's like a giant puzzle, and you start by building the frame, and you build in, and suddenly more pieces fit together as you get the frame together. But anyway, in 2007, there was a Gulfstream jet that crashed in the Yucatan in Mexico with 4 tons of cocaine on board, and caused a big stir back then. And you know, some media looked into it, and we spent a good time looking into it. And it turns out, and this is all provable, that that particular Gulfstream jet, at the time it crashed, it had just been sold to two guys, one of which is, you know, provably through court records connected to past CIA, FBI, DEA covert operations in Mexico. So we have a known operative who owned this plane that crashes with 4 tons of cocaine, and the plane itself, according to European investigators, is connected to Guantanamo flights, rendition flights. And it had been to Guantanamo Bay, according to flight records. The same plane that crashed, that got sold, that just happened to have 4 tons of cocaine on board. And one of our sources, Baruch Vega, was also a known CIA asset for years. He was involved back he goes way back in Latin America. He's a Colombian. And again, it's provable in court records that he's a CIA asset. Talked to us about this operation, was aware of it, and told us where the cocaine came from. It came out of Colombia from another guy named Urigo, who is now on trial down there, but he for a long time allegedly was a known CIA asset. He professed to be one. When he got busted, he said, "You can't bust me, I'm a CIA asset." So you have this cocaine trail, and at the time, what we were told by our sources, that it was an ICE, which is Department of Homeland Security, an ICE operation, but it didn't make a lot of sense. A lot like ATF. It was bringing, you know, it was trying to gather intelligence on the narco traffickers. But the big question is, okay, they were flying, this cocaine was coming up from Colombia, it was supposed to go to the States somewhere. And once it landed, who are they going to bust? They were all south of the border. So were you going to let all 4 tons of cocaine go into the circulation of the United States? The thing is, they've done this before, the CIA, and this is provable too, that in 1990, the Venezuelan National Guard was caught smuggling cocaine into the country. And the guy that was in charge of the general was a CIA asset. And he did this with the help of some CIA operatives in Venezuela at the time. And that's all proven in the Gillian case. You can look it up. And so it was supposedly an intelligence gathering operation. They let tons of cocaine into the country. Under Iran-Contra, they let tons of cocaine in the country. Now we're seeing a connection between, you know, a little more behind the curtain here, a connection between a Sinaloa cartel and the U.S. government and this cocaine plane, which, by the way, I'll finish the story. The additional facts about it is it shows up, Mexican government records say this particular cocaine, this Gulfstream that crashed, was purchased with money from the Sinaloa cartel. And it was money that was laundered through Casio de Campos, money houses in Mexico, owned by a Sinaloa, high-level Sinaloa financier, who was also using a U.S. bank to move this money. You needed both to launder it. It would go into the Casio de Campos and then up to the U.S. bank. And that bank was Wachovia. And they signed a consent agreement this year. Basically, they've been sold at Wells Fargo, but they signed a consent agreement agreeing not to be prosecuted and to pay back some money to the government. But this is all there. So you have the finances of the Sinaloa cartel tied to this jet. You have cocaine tied to this jet. You have the jet itself tied to the CIA, and you have one of the owners tied to working for past CIA operations. And you have this. Our sources telling us it's an ICE operation that makes no sense. And then somebody saying, well, it could be a CIA operation using an ICE cover. So that happens. I mean. You know, it helps you get through customs. And in fact, Baruch Vega, one of his jobs, the way he got known, was something called the Bogota Connection. His job was to go down with the CIA and the FBI and the DEA, and none of them knew which hat he had on. The CIA probably did. None of them knew which hat he had on at which time. But they were cooperating source recruiting trips going after the Cali cartel. And he recruited a bunch of these guys as cooperating sources or to do plea deals with the U.S. government with the help of the CIA, which would get him in and out of the country. They did this a lot of this out of Panama. So all this has happened before. This is not something new in the sense that the CIA or covert intelligence it reinvents the wheel every 10 years when they get found out. They just keep it running. But again, I don't think it's a situation where they're running drugs. Some of them may be, obviously, there's corrupt CIA people, depending on what your definition of corrupt is, that do it just to make money and are totally, you know, off the pasture and even by CIA standards are bad guys. But I think a lot of this, and if you talk to CIA agents, you know, or CIA officers, which are different, they'll tell you that you know, CIA is king overseas. I mean, they got their fingers and everything. And number two, intelligence penetrating other countries' governments and gathering intelligence and assuring their view of national security from that vantage point trumps everything, including drug trafficking. So they will use drug traffickers and arms traffickers as a means to their end. And that's been going on since Roman times, let's be honest about it. We just are kind of growing up to realize the extent of it and what the damage and the blowback. And that's one of the arguments is it worth it? And, you know, there you can have a legitimate argument. And I do have even CIA folks on the record saying the blowback from these kind of operations, these type of covert operations, always far worse than any benefit. But, you know, again, we have fear and greed driving this. And these are business interests they are more likely to take the short-term route to assure the short-term profit than to take the risk of doing it right in the long term for the benefit of both countries' national security, if you will, because ultimately they probably are aligned more than they're not. But we create a situation where I think we've really messed things up.
Well, to say the least, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you painting a realistic picture as opposed to the cartoon picture that we often get in the media. You cite, for example, the way they often talk about how it's one drug cartel fighting for turf with another and not really problematizing the issue in the way that it really is in real life. It's so many different layers of what's going on, including, of course, official collusion and the military involved with this. And then, of course, you get the American intelligence agencies involved with this. And it becomes a very, very murky world indeed. And one that, unfortunately, often becomes speculative because there's so little really to base it on, especially when they invoke such things as SEPA in their court proceedings. There's very little for us to go on. But I think one of the important points to note here is that there are so many different ways in which American intelligence agencies could be acting in this sphere, and it's difficult to know in what way they are. And for example, you raise the point that operations can often be cover for other, even more covert operations, which creates a very murky world of smoke and mirrors. So what can you say about the various possibilities of the ways that intelligence are involved here? And what really do you think is going on underneath these types of operations?
I all I can do is go on the past experience I've had covering similar cases or cases of clandestine operations. That, like you said, you can only know so much about. First of all, I know that world is very compartmentalized. So the operatives themselves only know part of the picture. And it's very much like the drug organizations. They're very compartmentalized. There's only you know, the players only know part of the picture. There's very few people that see the full, you know, the bigger picture. And even they're guessing because the bigger part of the picture is their enemies or the people they're working against. And they're, you know, so it's this hugely compartmentalized world where I don't think any one person has the insight into all of it. So you're always acting on incomplete information. So that's the first assumption. And so from that, you know, it results dysfunction generally. Because, you know, you're making bad moves as a result because you don't have good information. So there's always a quest to get better information and intelligence. To me, when I look back at one of the cases I covered, it was the first time I got jammed up on national security as an FBI agent named Lock Lau, who was recruited. He's from Taiwan. He spoke fluent Mandarin and Cantonese, so he culturally knew how to operate in China. So he was recruited. This was back in the So the late 80s, early 90s, when the Chinese were getting all their intelligence moles inside our agencies, like the FBI, if you recall, a lot of those. And so they wanted to do some payback on Chinese intelligence. That was the way it was put to me. And so they recruited this guy to penetrate Chinese intelligence. And his ultimate goal was to plant assets inside the Chinese intelligence service, you know, flip people to get inside, turn them to our side, have them essentially become cooperating sources for us. Very dangerous work, extremely dangerous work. He was so deep undercover, his own FBI agents didn't know he was doing this. And he was doing it via an executive order signed by Reagan that's still in effect, has been modified, but essentially empowers the FBI to do clandestine spy work overseas with the approval of the CIA, so in conjunction with the CIA. So he was... That goes to your cover again. He was an FBI agent working as essentially a CIA job with a cover of a knock cover. Basically, he was going over there as a business guy. So if he would have been caught, as he said, you would get a bullet in the head and they'd send the bill to his mom. So he was not in a, you know, and this guy flaked out. That's how it all came out. He did it. He pulled it off. But then the FBI fucked him. Excuse me. The FBI, you know, didn't keep their promises and screwed him over. And he had severe psychological problems as a result, too, and PTSD, et cetera. And they drummed him out, even without the benefits. So he had to fight him, and that's all this stuff started coming out in the court, in his court case. And I was covering it. And, so essentially what that tells me is, you know, the one common thing I see with the Zambada case, to that case, to Baruch Vega, is... part of the game is always to get inside your opponent and to get, you know, behind their front lines, if you will, or inside their head. And, you know, so it doesn't matter if you really have someone inside as a cooperating source sometimes, or if you, as long as your opponent thinks you do, that's as important sometimes as having them there, because it affects the way they operate. And so clearly part of the game in every one of these that I've covered has been to get, you know, on the individual level, to get somebody inside the target. And the way Lok Lau initially penetrated Chinese intelligence, and this is very telling, is by going through the Asian gangs, and essentially the Asian drug organizations. Because the theory is, and it's very true, that any country with a drug problem, including ours, has a high degree of corruption, and that corruption goes pretty high up into their governments. So if you can get inside, you know, the criminal element and convince them you're a criminal and rise within that element, you can get into a position in the government to affect your plan. And at least that's the way he did it. Now, that's all, like, tactics and procedures that people aren't supposed to know, and we went through that battle, but it came out. So that's not a secret anymore, and it shouldn't be. I mean, it's common sense. I mean, it's in the movies now, isn't it? Everyone knows that. But knowing what in the movies is real and what isn't is what the trick is. And so that part of it, I have no problem believing that U.S. intelligence and law enforcement, and sometimes you know, one of the ruses used by the FBI with Baruch Vega, Operation Gambit, was to have the FBI agent who is really acting overseas in a somewhat what you would consider traditional CIA territory, have the FBI agent pose as a corrupt FBI agent and to take kickbacks for these deals, like these or getting this information. Because the theory was that, I'm sorry, but it was, that it was more believable if you were corrupt, because then the cartels were more likely to believe it was a real thing. Because that's the way life is, right? So, yeah, there's plenty of twists and turns and so forth. But, you know, there's always an objective, and how you get there, that's where all the twists and turns are. But the objective has to be examined, and history helps you with that. It is just plainly evident that what we would consider national interest in Mexico would have to do with the markets. And, you know, I mean, who's in control here, and why we have people marching on Wall Street? Because, you know, corporate America has a lot of power in this country, and you can bet they are dictating national security interests in Mexico. And to the point where our government tools are being used to affect that. So what are the corporate national interests in what are our corporate interests in Mexico, which are really cross, you know, nowadays corporations are multinational. So what are the multinational corporate interests in Mexico and the United States in Latin America in general? And you get into what we have, what our struggle is now in our era. It really is defined by that. And you can go country by country and see it happening. And that's why issues like free trade are such explosive issues, and why, you know, the idea of crony capitalism and the whole, you know, we've evolved from colonialism and those were our colonies to, you know, this weird hybrid situation where what's good for, you know, GM isn't necessarily good for America anymore, but what's good for America happens to be good for GM, if that makes sense. I mean, so we can bail out the banks and we can bail out the auto companies, and it doesn't really make a difference in terms of how the world operates. You know, it keeps some people in jobs, and we all want that. But the long and short of it is corporate America, the corporate interests in America are similar to the corporate interests in Mexico, and they're aligned. And I think that's one way where you can look at where our policy would be directed and what we'd be trying to do. So we would, someone like Calderon makes total sense as a leader of that country and his administration. That's somebody we can more or less control much more than we could someone like his opponent in that election, who was borderline socialist, right? Who wouldn't be necessarily, and who knows, I mean, they all come around, but wouldn't necessarily be as easy to deal with, might threaten some vital business interests in the country, that, you know, investment capital, bonds and stocks, etc., and oil offshore, and our, you know, and in addition to the you know, more or less fabricated national security concerns, although they're real in the sense that it can happen, but I don't think they're the driving forces that Mexico could be an entry point for some kind of attack on the United States or what have you. That clearly is part of the equation under it in terms of the way just from talking to these guys, they definitely obsess over that. But again, I think that's probably more concerned with them taking out a vital economic target than necessarily. I'm cynical. Maybe it's not so much directed at concern for my safety, you know, as you know, the infrastructure and property of the national security interests that they're trying to protect.
Well, that, you might say cynical, I say realistic, but yeah, unfortunately so. So I mean, that does go part of the way, I think, to answer why it would possibly be that U.S. intelligence agencies would be interested in any way cooperating or protecting or working with the Sinaloa cartel over another cartel, for example. I mean, what would be the strategic benefit? But perhaps, well, that traces back to connections with Wachovia and other such things.
You know, well, it's a big money game. I mean, you know, it's illegal, but, you know, it's only illegal for certain people. At certain levels, that doesn't matter. And we've seen that over and over, you know, in our history and world history. But so it throws off an immense amount of money. You can't ignore it. And so there's going to be players involved in it at some level. Even if they're trying to regulate it, then they're thinking about, well, how can we, you know, regulate it or control it in such a way that it's at most advantageous, even if we can't or don't want to snuff it out. There's bankers involved. I mean, one of the first stories Narco News did is about the connection between some of the big bankers in Mexico. That bank is now part of Citibank, was, you know, had cocaine landing on his property. I mean, so the line between who is a criminal, who is not, breaks down real quick at the higher up in the 1%, as they now like to define it, that 1% of the population that lives in that rarefied air. The laws are different for them, which is part of the reason people are upset, right? But that would apply in the drug world, too. But secondly, the theory is, and I don't know, again, I don't necessarily, I really like to be careful. When I put it in a story, I make clear it's conjecture, it's opinion. And I'll tell you, this is fact. I know this is the case. What it could mean, you know, you got to use your judgment as a reader. But, you know, I'll throw in, you know, some of the possibilities. And it's long been suspected in Mexico. It's not a surprise in the Mexican press. I mean, they've long suspected the Sinaloa cartel has been favored by the Calderon administration. One of the operating theories is some of the money used to get Calderon over the top, you know, that the Sinaloa cartel, Chapo Guzman, backed Calderon in the election, and will again. And so there's a quid pro quo there. It's not necessarily a friendly relationship, but there's you know, one side can help the other. The bigger theory in it seems to be that it would be better to have one monopoly organization in Mexico than a lot of individual drug organizations, that you know it'd be easier to control that one organization. And if that's the Sinaloa organization, I mean, that's a theory under going back to the days of Zedillo, before Fox, even up until Fox, that the Juarez cartel occupied that position. If you read some of Charles Bowden's work, he's, you know, probably the best drug war journalist out there. I mean, he's got evidence that he's dug up where there's been meetings between generals where they've made these kind of deals, where they've essentially had the heads of the cartels with the generals and the politicians and made cut deals that say, you know, we'll let you do this if you promise to do that. In exchange for keeping the violence down, we'll, you know, let you run drugs, you know, and you know, the military has been enlisted to even help in some cases. So it's clear this happens. Now, what the particular arrangements are, and because of what I said earlier, that these are very, the alliances are shifting, they're very tenuous deals. The fact that they're here today, they could be gone tomorrow because someone betrayed someone, you know, someone was treacherous and it didn't work out the way they thought, which is why I think these are all foolhardy. And there's a thinking that the you know, by the foil heads, that the CIA is all-knowing. The CIA is a bureaucracy, like anything else. It has some really good people in it, some real doozers, right? And depending, you can agree with it or not agree with it. What I mean by really good, they're at least principled, and that you know what they're about. And there's other ones that are just, you know, like you know, and the people they work with, you know, the assets they work with. A lot of times they're criminal. They're dirt. They're not the kind of people that you would trust in a regular business deal, but they deal with these people. So with that kind of organization, and it's a huge bureaucracy, to think that, you know, you're going to actually make a plan that works to control an entire nation is ludicrous. So most of what they do is react, I think, to screw-ups from before. And thinking, probably saying, well, it's better that we do something than nothing, because otherwise someone else will do it to us. So, like I said, this is, you know, the intelligence agencies and this covert type activity has been going on since there's been an empire, you know, and so is the drug trade, for that matter, right? So this is really old stuff. We just get to spend 70 or 80 years watching it play out in our generation. Whether we can fix it or make it go away, I don't know.
Well, as you say, a lot of it is reactive and ad hoc based on things that have developed out of previous actions that they've done. And then there's the added, I suppose, level of mystery surrounding things that are, as you say, compartmentalized, so that some people within agencies don't know what even the people they're working with are doing involved in the same operation. So it can be obviously an incredibly dense area to really try to maneuver around in. And in that regard, you raise the specter of Gary Webb and, of course, his seminal reporting on the Dark Alliance series and the CIA Iran-Contra drug running back in the 80s and all of that incredible story that he uncovered and did such incredible investigative reporting in order to uncover. And then, as a result, he was assassinated twice, once professionally by the New York Times and the LA Times and all of his supposed brethren in the journalism business. And then secondly, when he was supposedly committed suicide by gunshot wound to the head twice. Make of that what you will. But it does obviously raise the question of being a journalist working in this area and reflecting on the legacy of Gary Webb. I mean, what can you say about people who are trying to actually put these pieces together from the outside?
Well, first of all, with Gary, you know, I got to know him right before he died, and other people knew him better. I don't necessarily, you know, you could have, I don't think he was assassinated. I think it's very likely it does happen that people, and Gary was the kind of guy, if anyone was going to decide to take himself out and it didn't work the first time, he would make, he had that kind of willpower. But you can, regardless of what you believe about that, they clearly destroyed him. And that's what they typically do to U.S. journalists. If you're in Mexico, you get killed, no doubt. If you're in nowadays, Gary may have been dragged to Mexico, whatever. But the point is, in the United States, the way they deal with journalists that get out of line, they just destroy their careers. They destroy them and their credibility in their careers to the point where they're ineffective, right? That's the goal. And it's a lot easier and it's a lot less messy and there's a lot less to clean up after that. And that's definitely something that can happen. But the thing about the goal of any of this, like any journalism, it's like the first draft of history, they say. Well, I think it is, you know, and what I'm covering are tactics. What Gary covered were tactics. And tactics over time put together start to reveal strategy. And once you have strategy, it starts to point to goals. And once you can line the goals and the strategy and the tactics up, you start to make sense of our world, at least as much sense as you can. And so, you know, it's always easy to look back and say, well, this is what the United States was trying to do in Latin America in the 80s, right? It seems clearer now than it did at the time. But I think that's because, and some of that may be right, and there's a whole other history we don't know that never got written. So part of it is to make sure as much of the history gets written so that there's a record of it. I mean, I put up all the documents. I mean, I don't expect you to believe me. I half expect you to believe that I talked to the people I say I did and they said what they said, but that isn't even a given. But I will get primary source documents and get the, and Gary was innovative that way too. That was what made his piece so powerful. Most people don't realize it was right in the dawn of the internet age. And he put all these, I mean, it wasn't just his stories. He put all the original source material out there. And you can still get that. Narco News is one of the few sites you can go to and get his whole series. And I'd recommend people go there and read it. To this day, it's I think, a must read. And then you can get the OIG report and see how it was whitewashed. But the point is, that record is there. And I built on Gary's record. In order for me to even start understanding where to start, I had to read Gary's. So, and that's all you can do is just build on each other. And the goal is, you know, I don't think you change the world. I believe that, you know, the way the democracy was set up is, if it works, people are informed and people make informed decisions and they make them based on having as much knowledge about what their government's up to and the people that are leading it and the people that are trying behind the scenes to take it over and direct it in ways that shouldn't be. That information is necessary for a democracy to function. Whether it's blind idealism and maybe democracy is as dead as a doornail in our age, I don't know. But I still kind of believe in it. So that's why I do it. I really think it's important. I don't think any of us as individuals are going to change these historic things that have been going on a long time. But we can shine a light on them so people in our generation and hopefully my kids' generations can see how it works so they are informed about it and they can make some wiser decisions as a result.
I agree. I think that's exactly the point. We have to have some sort of understanding of what's happening in order to understand how better to navigate ourselves through this world, whether or not we can actually affect massive change in it. But as you mentioned, of course, Narco News does host a mirror of the Complete Dark Alliance website as it originally appeared. So I do definitely recommend people go and check that out and use that resource, which is, again, an incredible resource that was compiled back in the mid-90s at the dawn of the internet era. And it does raise the question of Narco News itself and what it is. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that resource.
Yeah, well, with Narco News, like I said in the beginning, it was started back in 2000. It's been around quite a while. And it was just Al Giordano is kind of the person that envisioned it. He did it with a laptop. He went to Latin America, and you know, he's got a history in the United States as a community organizer and as a media guy. But he kind of gave up in the late 80s, the late 90s on the U.S. It just wasn't. So he went to Latin America and into the Chiapas right at the time all that was happening, and it all came out of there. And he started covering the drug war from south of the border, and it's now a 501c3. It's a nonprofit. So we survive completely on reader donations and some, we put on workshops in Mexico and in the States, teaching people, civilians, how to do civilian journalism. You know, give them the tools to go out and do journalism, to cover their own movements, to cover their own, you know, organizations and what they're doing. But primarily, it's set up to cover democracy movements and the drug war. And so the teaching on the journalism is around those two things. And, you know, it's run on a skeleton staff. It barely has any money, like all my product. I mean, literally, I don't think you could pay a reporter at a major daily. You couldn't keep a reporter at a major daily for the amount of money it runs on. So most people, I do it, believe most people involved are contributing for free. There's a skeleton crew that keeps the framework and the site up and the organizational things behind the scenes. So it's very small scale, but has a lot of collaborators across the South and North America. And that's really what we're about. So each of us has our own little thing that we're interested in. And so you'll go in there and it'll spark up and there'll be a lot of coverage on the drug war. And then, you know, lately there was a lot of coverage on the movement in Mexico. Javier Sequila, whose son was murdered by drug thugs, and his spawn, and he's a journalist for Proceso, who started this movement in Mexico to end the drug war. It's the first nonviolent movement against the drug war, in history, really, in Mexico. So it's a big deal. So that we've been covering that a lot. And so you'll get some hope, and you'll get some, you know, my coverage admittedly is, you know, if you read too much of it, it's hopeless, but it's got the facts you need. But there's the other side of it, and we try to do both. And I think if you take what you know about the dark side of the drug war and look at the positive change that can come by people, you know, getting organized and collectively, you know, doing things that make sense in a strategic way toward a goal to end it, you know, that gives you a big picture. We're not, because we are nonprofit, we're not partisan. I mean, people call us what we will, but we're not pushing Democrats or Republicans or that kind of crap. It really is about the journalism, no advertising. That won't change. And if that would make life easier for everyone, I guess, but it also would end the journalism pretty quickly. So, that's what it's about. So I would check it out, and you can participate in it. That's the nice thing. If you really have an interest and you have figure a way, get a hold of us and see if you got something you want to get out there and, you know, we can make it work, we will.
Exactly. Well, in the grand tradition of don't hate the media, become the media, I think Narco News is a shining example of that ethos. And certainly your work there is an integral part of what's going on there. And once again, I would recommend it to people, not only, of course, for the reporting that you're doing, but also for the fact that you're including source material and documents that people can use to really plumb the depths of what's going on, which, again, it's just so complicated and there's so much to it. But I think unless we start taking a look at these types of things and really understand the world as it's shaping up around us, how will we ever be able to really navigate ourselves through it? So Bill Conroy, thank you very much again for your time today, and I certainly hope we can talk again in the future about some of these issues.
All right, well, I appreciate it. It was good talking with you.